Judge, may it please the court, my name is Charles Powers. I represent the appellant in this matter, who was a husband in a divorce case in Rockland County for the spousal support obligation. He was terminated from his employment, and the issue becomes whether the trial court implemented what I refer to and what I think the evidence clearly shows was a mandatory imputation of income.
Counsel, may I interrupt you and ask you, did the circuit court actually exercise its discretion in this case before it imputed income to the husband?
It did not exercise discretion.
Okay, well, didn't the court expressly reference Murphy and quoted its holding?
It did quote Murphy. It did go through, because I had argued the whole history of the mandatory imputation
of
income.
Also, didn't the court, when it reviewed that, didn't it also reduce husband's support obligation as far as the spousal support, I think by maybe somewhere in the ballpark of 25%?
It did because the wife had then become employed. So there was a change of circumstance, which the court did grant the relief, but the relief...
Which would be the exercise of discretion by the court, would it not?
I think that's a different issue, Judge. We're talking about the imputation of income, and he said specifically, the trial court said, I'm going to impute income. And the trial court's specific ruling was, you're at fault for being terminated. I'm going to impute income. I'm paraphrasing.
Okay. Then does Murphy apply?
He did not apply Murphy because by doing that, he took one fact and totally ignored the discretion that the court has in looking at all the facts and actually looking, the second argument is looking at what really is the focus.
Well, Mr. Powers, you pulled out one sentence later on in where he's ruling and said, my understanding of what he said, no discretion of, is that once I found that I have to impute whatever he was making before minus whatever he's making now, once I find I'm going to impute, the thing he seemed bound by was the earlier salary. But at page 81 of the appendix, as Judge Chafin has referenced, he says, although I think I've honed in some language in the Murphy case that bolsters your decision, I think he's talking to you about your argument and not your decision because, well, you weren't making decisions, you were making arguments. The trial court has the discretion to impute income to either or both of the custodial or non-custodial parent who is voluntarily unemployed. And, of course, if you lose your job for your own cause, you're voluntarily unemployed or underemployed. That seems to be the court saying, I have the discretion to do this. He then goes on to find he's voluntarily unemployed and then says, once I find that he's voluntarily unemployed for not a good, and that I'm going to impute income, which he has said at discretion, then doesn't he have to use the salary that was in place at the time?
That's what he said there. That's not actually what I'm arguing here today.
Question is, given that he said that, isn't that what... Why wouldn't we conclude that that's what he did?
I think his specific ruling, the actual ruling came after he took a break. It's on the page 84 of the decision. And he's talking about, I'm going to rule that the husband has not carried his burden of proof. I find that it's his fault that he's at fault for losing the job. And the entire discussion back and forth was he at fault? And my argument to the court, and what I'm arguing here also today, is you need to look at fault from the point of view of the employee. What the trial court did is determined the employer said, I think there was some fault for him getting terminated, and therefore I'm just going to impute income to you.
I want you to assume something for me that I know
yes,
you don't want to assume.
Yes.
Assume that the trial court actually believed it had the discretion to determine whether to impute under this circumstance and made a discretionary decision to impute. Okay?
Okay.
If the trial court did that, where are we?
If the trial court had made a discretionary decision to impute, it would have... I guess that takes me into the second argument,
well,
Judge.
I assume it did it. If the trial court considered whether to impute, considered it had discretion, and then did make the decision to impute, then your imputation argument just kind of fades away, except for whether the record established he was at fault.
The mandatory. My argument about whether or not it was mandatory. If the trial court had said that I'm going to consider all the facts and make a determination, but he did limit it to If I find fault, I'm going to impute income, period. That's the way it was phrased. That's the way it was presented to the parties.
If I'm fired for my own fault, if that's why I'm voluntarily underemployed or unemployed, what Murphy talks about is you have to consider, and the statute talks about, is the reasonableness of the decision.
Yes, Judge. And that's the second argument, probably the more compelling argument, is the court has to look at what is, from the point of view of the employee, because we're talking about voluntarily unemployment. Involuntary is an act that someone takes on their own free will.
Well, except that it's expanded to cover situations with fault. So if we find fault, then isn't the trial court right that that there's no reasonableness to the decision to engage in fault behavior and get fired?
Judge, I think if there's fault that's being alleged and has to be proved that he, the employee, the husband, is at fault, to fit into the scheme of the statute and making it voluntary, there has to be something that the employee has done. Because the standard is whether or not the employee, defining fault, has purposefully avoided or careless disregard for a spouse's support obligation. There's no evidence about the husband here purposefully avoiding his job, doing anything, because the evidence is clear and undisputed that the husband was never told that there were ongoing problems.
If I get fired for punching my boss in the face, because and all the evidence, everybody agrees, the reason I punched my boss in the face was I was mad at him. Yeah. It had nothing to do with my spousal support obligation. Can you impute income in that circumstance?
That does rise to the level. That's a level above and beyond. I guess for lack of a better way to look at this, he wasn't particularly pleased with his performance, job performance, the employer, and never told him about it.
Right. But my question is, in that hypothetical, can the trial court impute?
And that's the other argument. It's something that you knew or should have known. And I think a reasonable person would know if you punch your boss in the face, you're going to get terminated. There's a line of cases about people who commit crimes and are incarcerated, and that they impute income to them because you're committing a crime. You know that's not the right thing to do. You know you're going to lose your job. But the employer here testified that there was some problems with car sales and employee turnover. But he also testified, but I never told him about it. He had told him about it years earlier. He had corrected it. This is what the evidence clearly shows, but never said that there was ongoing problems. And he didn't have to. We never disputed that. I think maybe what the judge did is mistook the fact that he didn't have to tell him anything, that you have no obligation to tell your employee that you're doing a bad job, you need to fix it, or put them on some sort of notice or not. That's not the employer's point of requirement. It's the employee, vis-a-vis his spousal support obligation or his child support obligation, is what is he doing to maintain his job and not lose it? And that's what the crux of my argument is. He's never told. He may or may not have been at fault in the eyes of the employer, but whether
Counsel,
he did something.
May I ask you, clearly, your client saw that there was some deterioration of sales, there was problems in the repair or mechanic area that his son was working in. He knew those things. He had been alerted to that some years before. It really hadn't improved that much. And in fact, hadn't he missed when some of the larger companies came in? Didn't he miss some of those days when he was supposed to be on the job?
Judge, that was there was a 2014 meeting between the employer and
right.
the husband.
But if that.
Counsel,
if that didn't improve from 2014 and was ongoing until the hearing day or until the time in which he was terminated, then surely he was on notice. He was the manager. I mean, he looked at those numbers. He was on notice.
He was told in 2014 specifically that here's the problem. And then in 2014, about a month after that, he and the employer, the boss, sat down and they agreed that things are fine. And that's what happened after that. There's a specific, there's a document that the employer signed, the employee signed, saying we've resolved these issues, go forth. And he did do that.
But if it backslid after that, wasn't he on notice that those things could get him fired?
He was on a note. One, there's no evidence that any of the specific incidences outlined were still ongoing problems, especially when the employer says, if I have a problem with you, I'm going to tell you about it. That's how that company was run. So I'm going into my rebuttal time. If you have no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of it.
Hey, please the court. My name is Richard Locke, and I represent Tammy King, formerly Tammy Parham, in this case. After working 25 years for Page Auto Group, Mr. Parham was fired in November of 2016. My final divorce decree had been ordered to pay $12,000 a month in spousal support based on a $344,000 salary. He filed a motion to amend, and the court heard evidence on that case and ultimately reduced her spousal support from $12,000 to $9,000 a month. The husband in this case raises three specific assignments of error. The first is the judge used an improper legal standard to this case, that he didn't exercise any discretion. But at page 81 of the transcript, as Justice Russell said, he specifically outlined the exact legal standard that he had to exercise, that he had the discretion to impute income if he found that the person was voluntarily underemployed. And that was the specific founding that he made. He articulated the correct legal standard. He heard the evidence and determined that he was voluntarily underemployed. So his first assignment of error is without merit. His second assignment of error is that he didn't consider the good faith and reasonableness of husband's employment decisions. The problem here is husband didn't make the employment decision. He was terminated by Page Auto Group for cause. So I'm not sure what employment decisions the appellant is referring to that the court was required to consider, but he didn't make any.
Not saying this is the case, but it seems to me that there could be a circumstance where you are fired for insubordination because you were instructed to roll back an odometer, and you refused because that's an illegal act. Now, you did make a voluntary act in that you committed an act of insubordination, but wouldn't that be a circumstance that the trial court considered that, yes, you were fired for cause and the cause was insubordination, but you had a valid good reason for the insubordination?
I think that's correct. So I think Mr. Powers is correct that the statute doesn't limit the good faith and reasonableness to a decision to voluntarily walk away from a job. It could include decisions that you make on the job, and whether those decisions are reasonable. For example, what you just stated, you're asked to engage in some type of improper or illegal conduct and you don't do it and then you're fired, then I think the trial court could perfectly determine that your employment decision not to engage in that illegal conduct was a proper one, and being fired for that would not be justification to determine that you're voluntarily underemployed. That's not what happened in this particular case. We made the argument in our brief that the section on good faith is a child support section, and this was primarily a spousal support case. And Mr. Deal raises in his book that there may be separate standards for spousal and child support case. I'm aware of this court's decision that said you can't impute income in child support and not do it in spousal support. So there is a little bit of a statutory dilemma in this case, but I don't think it matters in this case ultimately, because the crux of this case, as Mr. Power says, is whether or not he was dismissed for cause. And that really is his third assignment of error.
Counsel, what you're talking about is that Murphy v. Murphy, has only been applied as to child support, and that's consistent with the statute. It has not been applied in reference to spousal support at this time.
That's correct. In fact, the statute that has that good faith requirement is the child support statute, and specifically says it's for child support. But I don't think the discretion that a court has to determine whether somebody is voluntarily unemployed would preclude them from analyzing the exact issues that Justice Russell raised, for example, being asked to engage in some type of illegal or improper conduct. The real crux of this case is the third assignment of error, whether or not there was any, whether his decision was plainly wrong because there was no credible evidence to support the judge's finding that he had been dismissed as a result of his own conduct. I think what Mr. Powers said now a few minutes ago is not accurate, that 60 days after the September 2014 meeting, there was a meeting where Mr. Page, who was the owner of the Page Auto Group, said everything's fine. That's not what happened. In fact, in September of 2014, Mr. Page gave Mr. Parham a document that identified six specific deficiencies in his performance with Page Auto Group. One of those was that the used car department was in shambles, that he had hired his son to manage that department, and that his son was not an effective manager. One of the other ones is that he was belittling, threatening employees. And then he identified five specific things he wanted him to do immediately, and that was at the back of the same memo. 60 days later, the parties met, and there was an agreement that he had done the five specific things that he'd been asked to do. But those five specific things didn't deal with all six of the problems that had initially been identified. For example, there was nothing in the five specific items that said anything about the used car dealership and his son. For example, you need to fire your son. That wasn't one of the specific things that happened in that memo. It didn't say anything about in the five specific things that you need to do that you shouldn't belittle employees. But what happened and what Mr. Page testified to in 2016 is that the problems that existed in 2014 still existed. And he was asked whether any of them had gotten better. He said that the belittling and threatening of staff had gotten better, but still existed. He specifically said that the used car department was still in shambles. And there's absolutely no evidence in the record that Mr. Parham did anything to address that very specific concern that his employer had raised in 2014.
With the belittling of employees, obviously that would be under Mr. Parham's control. There are, and yet while the used car department may have been his responsibility, is there any evidence at all that its continued lack of performance or its lack of performance in the 2 points could have been affected by decisions he made? Did Mr. Page say he was supposed to fix it, he could have fixed it, he didn't fix it?
Yes, what he said in 2014 was that the used car department is in shambles, and the reason it's in shambles is because you have hired your son, not the son of the parties, but his son, to manage the used car department, and that he is not an effective manager. So Larry Page tells him in 2014, the used car department is in shambles. It's because of the manager that you hired to run that department. So Mr. Parham had the discretion as the general manager of the entire automobile dealership to hire whoever he wanted to replace his son as the used cars manager, to take it out of the shambles that it was in and correct it. And he did. There's absolutely nothing in the record that suggests he did anything from 2014 forward to fix that particular
problem.
Does
the record establish his son was still managing it?
I don't think the record establishes his son was still managing it, but there's nothing. I mean, the burden is on him to show that he's not voluntarily underemployed. He didn't put on any evidence to suggest that he'd corrected it. And as Mr. Page testified, it was still a problem in 2016 when he fired it. In fact, he identified...
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
If we look at it, because time's running, but if we look at it, the judge that heard this case had an opportunity to hear from Mr. Parham. Is that correct? He testified.
He testified.
And you also presented testimony in reference to his employer, that information. Did the court hear that? So the court had an opportunity to determine the credibility of each witness and make those fact findings. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And the ultimate question for this court is the decision plainly wrong without credible evidence to support it. And I was getting ready to point out the five specific things that Larry Page said still existed in 2016 that had not been corrected. Again, the used car department was still in shambles. Although the belittling of the staff had gotten better, it was still a problem. One of the things he had specifically raised in 2014 that there was tons of turnover within the whole automobile dealership, that hadn't gotten better. There were still tons of turnover. In fact, Mr. Page was asked after Mr. Parham was relieved of his responsibilities, had that problem gotten better, and he said it was fine now. He had identified a new problem that had popped up since the 2014 issue, which was now that there were problems with new car sales that Mr. Parham was responsible for. And an additional new problem that he mentioned is that now morale within the entire employee group was low. So he identified three specific things that had initially been identified in 2014 that had not been corrected, and two additional problems. So there was overwhelming credible evidence to support the judge's factual finding that he had been dismissed for as a result of his own conduct, and therefore he did not. We would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision and award Ms. Parham or Ms. King her attorney's fees. Thank you.
Mr. Powers.
Judge, there's still nothing in the record that Mr. Parham was ever advised that there were ongoing problems. And the fault...
Would it be reasonable to conclude that the general manager of the automobile dealership would be aware of new and used car sales and whether they were meeting historical benchmarks?
Yes, it would be. And in fact, Mr. Parham talked about what he was told and what he knew of going on. But on appeal, we can disregard everything Mr. Parham said. I'm looking at what Mr. Page said, what the employer said. And it's without dispute that there were no discussions. No one pointed out, said, Mr. Parham, you're having a problem here. And what Mr. Parham said is, if I was told, I would have fixed it. I would have done something.
Well,
but again, and he had done that in the past.
Well, there were three things. Well, take the belittling of employees. It had gotten better, but it had not been eliminated. So isn't that known fault?
He was advised in 2014, I have problems with what's going on here. He corrected them. The last contact that he and his employer had was, okay, let's go forward.
Do I have to tell you every month not to belittle the other employees?
No, you don't have to tell you every month. But if it's an ongoing problem, and if the expectation is that you're supposed to fix or do something to comply with your job, make sure that you're not avoiding your obligations, which is what the crux of a spousal support or child support case is what are you doing with respect to your obligation? And if you're just throwing it away, if you're told that this is still a problem and you're advised of it to some extent, then you have to take action. If there was one scintilla of evidence that any of these items was specifically said or even hinted at, I think we'd be in an entirely different place right now. But there's absolutely no evidence that anything was ever said or done to advise Mr. Parham that, yes, there's these problems, you're at risk of losing your job unless you do something, and then the voluntary act he would have to then undertake under the statute, voluntarily underemployment, unemployment, is to recklessly disregard that, just say, well, too bad, I'm going to do whatever I want to do because I want to reduce my spousal support obligation. There's no evidence to that effect. And I think that's the crux of what we're arguing here and what the judge, what his misinterpretation and misapplication of the statute was, and that's what the error is. If there's no further questions, I'll submit the rest of it on brief.
Thank you, Mr. Powers.
Thank you.